This episode of the Airplane Geeks podcast is brought to you by ComAvia, delivering leading-edge media to the aviation industry. ComAvia, the company the aviation industry turns to for the best in new media marketing communications. Visit them at commmavia.com. Welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast. This is episode 350 of the show where we talk aviation. I'm Max Flight, and joining me this episode as co-host is Rob Mark. He's a pilot, a flight instructor, an aviation journalist, and he also publishes the Jetwine blog. Hi, Rob.
Well, good evening to everyone, and I just have to share this incredible news. I came back from Florida this afternoon on United Airlines, and everything went perfectly.
Oh, Rob.
Yay.
It really was a good experience. Maybe that's because they knew that you were on the flight and you'd said a few things about United service in the past. What do you think?
Well, it is funny, but one of the flight attendants in the rear recognized me, and it turned out to be one of my neighbors. So I still think it was coincidence, though.
Well, we're glad to have you back. Also joining us this episode is our associate producer, Brian Coleman. Brian, you've been traveling as well, I think.
Hey, Max. Hi, Rob. Yeah, I have done now over 60,000 miles so far this year. And the last trip, although it was a short one, I actually got to take almost planes, trains, and automobiles. I went down to San Diego and actually took Amtrak, and it didn't derail, so that was good.
Yeah.
And then I flew up to San Francisco and back down again. And I still have my German germ, so if my voice sounds a little off, that's the reason why.
Those things kind of linger. I hope that clears up for you soon. It's no fun to have a bug that goes on and on and on and on.
No, we call them wunder bugs. Think. All right.
All right. Our guests this episode are, we have two guests, Scott B. and Sandy Guthrie. They're executive producers and co-creative directors at Antenna Films. Now, these two have been making films for, more than 20 years, I guess, and they formed Antenna Films in 2000 to tell compelling stories. And their work has appeared on National Geographic, Discovery, A&E, Lifetime, Sundance TV. Their current aviation projects include the award-winning Virgin Galactic series that followed the development of the world's first space line, and also this documentary, Looking Up, Way Up, the Burt Rutan story. So Scott and Sandy, welcome to the Airplane Geeks podcast.
Hi, Max.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
You both have a lot of impressive credits, and we'll put some of those in the show notes at airplanegeeks.com. But Sandy, I understand that editing is your passion. Is that right?
Well, it is. I started as an editor in New York more years ago than I want to say, but that's how I got into this business. But I actually have been also producing and directing and executive producing for quite a while. But I still do get my hands dirty quite often and really still love to edit as well.
Well, maybe some other time you and I can commiserate on the editing task. Sometimes editing this podcast can be quite a chore, and you probably could help me with some tips to do that based on your experience. It's a real challenge sometimes.
It is, but for me, it's such a creative part of telling stories, and certainly to make films or documentaries. Telling the story takes a lot of different types of skills, but it's a very fun part of the process to get into the editing room and work with your footage and your characters and story.
Yeah, and I think, having done this, I think that editing is a lot more of a creative process than I ever thought that it was.
But, yes, I think that's very true. And I think, it's somewhat technical now that it happens on computers, but the really good editors are the people that bring very, very strong creative vision into the editing room. And having been an editor and also supervised a lot of editors, it's the most important thing to have good creative storytelling skills.
Now, Scott, is it true that your start in motion pictures was with Super 8 and 16 millimeter films?
I actually went to New York to be an artist and got caught making short films when I traveled to Arizona to build a house. And a friend of mine went to or came out with me and was making underground films, literally underground films in mine shafts. And when I went back to New York City, I started making Super 8 films and showing them in rock and roll clubs and doing serials where every week we'd make another 15-minute segment, and gradually started making features and got into it that way.
Hmm. Super 8. Were you using Super 8 film like that because it was that long ago, or was it for effect?
No, it was that long ago, and okay. It was kind of the equivalent of what people are doing on the internet now. In fact, at the time, I thought this was the democratizing sort of media that was going to be, allow everyone to tell a film story, which didn't really come to pass with Super 8, but certainly has. It's certainly happening right now.
Yes, so absolutely.
It's kind of the same thing.
All right. Well, we're going to focus on the work Sandy and Scott are doing with Burt Rutan coming up. But first, we have some aviation news we're going to discuss, including airline systems security, hacking, and a bug bounty program. We've also got another, unpleasant, let's say, incident with an autistic passenger. Also, a passenger who really needed to make an emergency call but was prevented from doing that. And crowdfunding a startup airline. Very interesting. We do have an Australia Desk report this week. The boys talk about the RAF KC-30As making boom contacts. Also, Andrew Jacko Jackson has flown the first RAF F-35. And the guys also give us a report on the Red Bull Air Race from Japan. We'll finish off with a little bit of listener feedback, but I think we better get started with the aviation news. Are you guys all ready?
Ready.
Our first story, this comes from ABC News. FBI investigating claim computer expert hacked plane in flight. Well, computer security expert Chris Roberts, he's told investigators that he hacked into the IFE system through boxes under the seats 15 or 20 times. He says he even, quote, caused one of the airplane engines to climb, resulting in a lateral or sideways movement of the plane. I think this is the guy that we talked about previously who had sent some tweets claiming that he was able to hack into the IFE system. And now we have the FBI investigating. They say that the electronics box under the seat does show signs of tampering, but they also say, quote, there is no credible information to suggest an airplane's flight control system can be accessed or manipulated from its in-flight entertainment system. So I guess this is sort of the raging debate amongst aviation professionals and enthusiasts is whether or not anything like this actually could occur. But the FBI is taking a look at the claims of this guy anyway. Brian, are you worried about flying in light of this kind of a story?
I can imagine, because I've seen those boxes under the seat. If there is a USB connection or DB9 connector or something that somebody was able to connect to the system and look around, I seriously doubt that he was able to make any control inputs to fly the plane. So am I concerned about it? Yeah, because it's electronics. Yeah, I'm always concerned about what idiots will do on an airplane. But I don't believe that the two systems, even on something like the 787, are connected. I don't know. Rob might have a different opinion on that.
No, I completely agree with you, Brian. And I think if I remember correctly, when we were talking about this a few weeks ago, when we had the drone folks on, I believe it was that show, and the same topic came up. I mean, to me, is it absolutely guaranteed that it couldn't happen? Of course not. But I seriously doubt that this happened and that no one ever heard anything about it. At very worst, if the pilots were up front and the airplane started doing some things that nobody planned, like, you know, the thrust on one engine coming back or the airplane rolling or whatever it was supposed to do, I find it hard to believe that they wouldn't have reported this anywhere. And again, all we have is this man's claim that he did it. There has been no credible evidence, at least that's been released to the public, that any of us know anything about. So, you know, again, I find this really, really tough to believe.
Yeah, and in a situation like this, like I think you're suggesting, Rob, the forensics, you know, if you will, after the fact, ought to be pretty good. I mean, if he did do something, there should be evidence of that.
Absolutely. The flight data recorders, our digital recorders that record, this was a 787, I think he said he did it on, wasn't it?
No, I think it was a 737.
737, I'm sorry. But even so, I mean, the digital flight data recorders on a 737 record well over 1,000 different parameters. And if this happened, was it not reported? And is it something the National Transportation Safety Board would know nothing about? I just find it hard to believe. I think this man is trying to make a name for himself. I think he believes he has a solution to the airline's ills, and that if someone would just listen to him, he could, save them a lot of work, and maybe he can. But then, to me, if you really had a great product and it was such a problem solver, I would have thought the better solution would be to get an audience somehow with some of the folks at Airbus or Boeing or Embraer and say, hey, give me 15 minutes of your time and let me show you something I can do with your airplanes that nobody thinks I can, that is going to be really important to you. Hmm. And I don't think any of that's happened.
Well, let me put Scott and Sandy on the spot just a little bit and ask, when someone like a Burt Rutan is designing an aircraft or a vehicle or a system like this, does security, either computer or otherwise, does that come into the equation when you're talking about developing and designing the craft?
Well, it certainly does these days when you're talking about spaceships. You're talking about fairly intense security. It's regarded as an ITAR issue, so that it's restricted in terms of even who can see what's under the surface on a ship. So,
sure.
So the security is a pretty big issue, at least in terms of that kind of thing.
All right, well, let's move on to our next story. This is kind of related. This is from United Airlines. They have announced a bug bounty program, and they have a webpage for this that we'll put a link in the show notes at airplanegeeks.com/350. And let me just kind of go over the first introductory paragraph of this. United says, at United, we take your safety, security, and privacy seriously. Okay, I'm glad to hear that. It says, we utilize best practices and are confident that our systems are secure. I hope so. We are committed to protecting our customers' privacy and the personal data we receive from them, which is why we are offering a bug bounty program, the first of its kind within the airline industry. I think that's brilliant. They say, we believe that this program will further bolster our security and allow us to continue to provide excellent service. If you think you have discovered a potential bug that affects our websites, apps, and/or online portals, please let us know. If the submission meets our requirements, we'll gladly reward you for your time and effort. Rob, I think this is kind of brilliant, don't you?
I think, considering the fact that it's United Airlines, I think it's double brilliant. I mean, because let's be serious about the only publicity United seems to be able to get most of the time is negative publicity. But I think they might just be onto something. And who's to say that a year from now they don't say, well, actually, you know, we've had three people that have given us this, that, or whatever, and we've rewarded them each with You know, are they going to do, I think, miles based on the intensity of the issue or something, I think, right?
Right. They've identified the kinds of the bugs or problems into low, medium, and high severity levels. And the low level includes things like cross-site scripting or request forgery, third-party issues that affect United. If you find a bug of those types, you could get up to 50,000 award miles. In the medium category, authentication bypass, brute force attacks, timing attacks, other things, that's a medium severity, and the award could be up to 250,000 miles. And then there's the high severity, the remote code execution type of bug. And you could find yourself with up to 1 million award miles. So the incentives are pretty good.
I wonder, I'm sorry, Rob. Go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, I wonder if they offered this to Mr. Roberts or if
it's not anymore.
Well, probably not. But hey, listen again. If the guy really has something, why not show it to United and make yourself a million miles?
Sure.
I don't know, but that's just me.
Yeah, yeah. What they're looking to do is attract what they call white hat hackers. And other industries do this. I know that, for example, there is an annual event where they invite a bunch of hackers to see if they can hack into Windows or Mac OS and things like that. There's some pretty significant awards. And it's a way to find out where the bugs are, you know, ahead of time, ahead of the, you know, the bad guys finding out. So I think this is a great move for United. I think it's a meaningful action. Maybe it'll be really interesting to see what people uncover, what kind of bugs people uncover.
It is, Max. I absolutely agree with you here. The problem that I have with this is, one, they've now said, hey, come find problems in our system. And sure, you'll have the good guys that go to do this for the miles to let them know about the service or the issue that they have. But what I'm really worried about are the bad hackers that come along just to screw with the system. And now all of a sudden they've compromised my personal data, they've stolen my miles, they've booked me on flights that I don't want to go to, they have my credit card information. I just see this as an open invitation to people stealing all of my stuff.
I guess I would say that if there are black hat hackers out there who are interested in United's systems, they're already looking, they're already poking. I don't know that this will generate any incremental problems of that sort. But, you know, maybe you're right.
Time will tell.
Moving on to the next item, we have another example of someone on an airplane with autism. We've had some of these in the past. The consequences haven't been real great. We first heard about this from our listener, Jeremy, so thanks for sending the link in. And he writes in and said, I saw this article and was amazed that it was the pilot who asked the entire family to leave the flight. To think that she didn't hurt anyone in flight, I suppose it was really just an issue of awareness regarding autism as to what it really is. He asks, are commercial pilots really allowed to kick off passengers off a flight just because they are uncomfortable with them being in the plane? And Rob, they do. A pilot, right, has the ability to make that judgment call if he thinks that the passenger is disruptive or potentially could impact the safety of the flight, correct?
Absolutely. That's always the captain's prerogative. And after I read this, I thought, well, you know, on the surface, it seems like maybe the crew made a bad call, but then let's be serious. We weren't there. And we don't, you know, when someone says someone was starting to make noises and be disruptive, we don't know what that sounded like or looked like. And these days, crews just don't want to take the risk. So yeah. It's kind of easy to Monday morning quarterback them. But, you know, again, I think we're going to have to hear a little more about it. But, you know, again, let's face it. Whenever we have an issue, there's no middle of the road. It's black or white.
Yeah, it's interesting to look at the ABC report on Yahoo. Of this, it's how a woman claims she and daughter with autism were kicked off United Airlines flight. And when I checked this morning, there were over 10,000 comments under that article, which I don't know if that's a record, but yeah, I've never seen anything generate that level of reaction from the readers. And as I went through it, and I obviously didn't get through all 10,000 of these comments, but you know what? There were both sides were represented. People who were sympathetic to the situation that autism sometimes presents, the difficult situations sometimes. And there were others who thought that, well, you know, if you have an autistic daughter, that you shouldn't, you know, she shouldn't be flying, and people taking that position as well. There were both sides were represented. I don't know if this is. If this is a public relations issue for United, certainly 10,000 comments suggest it might be.
Well, you know, one thing that's interesting, I think, at least basing it on the story, is it said that the mom waited until she was on the airplane and the airplane was in flight to tell the flight attendants that her daughter really needed a hot meal to remain calm. But I guess I'm wondering if the mom knew that. Why didn't she bring something along in the first place? But maybe I'm being, you know, maybe I'm oversimplifying it here.
Yeah, and it's like you say, Rob, it's difficult to know if we're in possession of all of the facts surrounding this. But yeah, it did involve this issue of food and the 15-year-old daughter being upset if the food was not heated. There was an exchange back and forth. The daughter, I guess, eventually did get the hot food, ate it, and then, according to the mother, 25 minutes later, an announcement came over the PA system that the flight was going to be diverted because of some situation. The police arrived, paramedics first, I guess. Paramedics came in, looked at the situation, decided there was nothing there for them to do. No need for them to be there at all. And the police came in, and I guess they were informed that the pilot wanted the family removed. Some of the passengers on board, observed this situation and thought that the whole thing was ridiculous and sort of unwarranted. But again, we'll have to sort of pass on this without having some more information. But it is an issue that comes up with autistic children, I guess, frequently. It may just be a situation of needing more awareness on the part of the cabin crew. I'm not sure.
Yeah, this is definitely a tough one.
Yeah. And then we have another story that it's different, but there's some interesting parallels. This is from AOL.com. Woman told she couldn't call suicidal husband during flight. And this was a woman on a Southwest Airlines flight. She received a text from her husband as she was on the plane. And the text said, "Karen, please forgive me for what I'm about to do. I'm going to kill myself." Well, you can imagine how you might feel if you were sitting on a plane and you received a text message like that from your spouse. Her reaction, of course, was to want to immediately call him and speak with him, but the flight attendant would not allow that, and she wasn't able to call anyone until the flight arrived. She called the police, and at that point, it was too late. Her husband had killed himself. That's a tough one. That's a tough call. I mean, when you have an emergency situation on a flight of this sort, which of course probably doesn't happen very often, but of any type. How do you know when you have to take action if you're part of the crew?
Do you know something I was asking, and I'm really just trying to clarify this here. Did she not realize that she couldn't make a call herself from cruise altitude? Or was she understanding that and she was expecting the pilots to somehow radio down to somebody on the ground and take care of that call? And it also seems like the flight attendants never told the captain, or that's kind of what the gist of it was, as I took from the story.
Yeah, I don't think the captain was informed, according to this story. And I think when she received the text message, I believe the plane was still on the ground, but they were in the, you know, airplane mode, you know, no personal electronic device kind of mode.
Oh, that's a shame. This is where if it were me and I was in the back seat of the airplane, I'd have said, I don't care. I'm making the call. And
exactly.
Off the airplane, well, then they threw me off the airplane, but at least I would have had a good reason for doing it. And honestly, I doubt seriously the captain would have given her any grief at all if he knew that there was a problem in the back and found out what it was. I believe 99 9/10% of the pilots out there would have said, absolutely, we'll sit here till we get this taken care of.
Yeah.
And explain that to people on the PA. I doubt anybody would give him any grief. But, you know, again, we may not have the whole story here.
Hmm. Yeah, but being a bad passenger and leaving my phone on when it should be in airplane mode, it seems like once you get to about 2,000 feet or so, the cell phone signal stops anyway. So if they were in flight or even shortly after takeoff, she wouldn't have been able to make a call. And all those wonderful GTE airphones that used to be in the seatbacks, they've been ripped out years ago. So how else would she have been able to call? Do pilots have the ability to talk to the controller to make a phone call and
no, but
you know, at least relay a message that way?
I'd certainly call back on the company frequency, and if they explained to them what was going on, the dispatch people could certainly have picked up the phone. I don't know if they would have had the ability to connect the aircraft up to a phone line, actually, and I'm not even sure they would want to do that in this kind of case.
Let's move on and talk about this startup, this Avatar Airlines. Rob, you found this just a few hours ago after you returned home, a press release. There's also an article in USA Today. But Avatar Airlines, they're going to try crowdfunding in order to build themselves a ultra low cost or low fare air carrier.
Well, and the reason I grabbed it when I saw it was that I thought it was a joke at first. I have never heard of anybody crowdfunding an airline. I mean, I guess it's certainly possible, but the $5 million that they're trying to gather isn't going to go very far when you're trying to put an airline together, even if you are ultra low cost, unless maybe you're flying DC-3s or something. You know? I don't know. It usually costs quite a few $100 million to get a carrier up.
Yeah.
So again, I thought this was kind of a joke, but especially when I saw their ultra low cost models, fares as low as $19.
And they're planning on using 747-400 aircraft.
I know. That's where they lost me. And I said, come on, these guys are kidding, right? I mean, everybody and their brother is trying to get rid of 74s because they're not very economical to operate any longer. So they're going to operate 747s on routes crowdfunded. Where are you going to fill up a 747? So, okay, we should put this in the show notes and let us know what happens.
Yeah, I thought it was odd enough to fund a movie through crowdsourcing, and clearly we'll get into that in a minute. But
oh, nobody would crowdsource a movie. Come on.
No, it's just, one of my questions here is going to be, I don't understand the economics of it, because I think making a movie costs a whole heck of a lot more than what they're asking for. So I'm very curious over that. But an airline, like you said, the numbers just don't add up. It's crazy.
Well, and really, do you want to fly? I see, again,
yeah.
It doesn't exactly send the best signal to potential passengers to say, we're the cheapest airline around, even though we're going to fly old airplanes that nobody wants much of anymore, and we only need $5 million to get going. So will you help us?
All All right. Well, let's ask our guests, Sandy and Scott. Sandy and Scott have actually used the Kickstarter campaign successfully, I guess, to fund this movie. Guys, again, welcome to the Airplane Geeks podcast. Tell us a little bit about how you used Kickstarter to fund this Looking Up, Way Up, the Burt Rutan story.
Well, we decided to use Kickstarter because part of the Burt Rutan film is that Burt is building a new airplane in his garage. And he was moving very quickly. And, you know, raising money for a documentary through traditional sources takes time, and it takes time to identify investors. And then it takes time just to make your deals and actually get your financing in place. And we knew that we needed some backing so that we could keep up with Burt because he was moving so fast. He's working up in Idaho and we're down in LA. So we just needed some basic startup money. We needed to kickstart our documentary project. And this is the first time we've done one. And so we decided to do it. And I think I know Scott will have more to add, but I think what we found is it turned out to be a really interesting project to do. I think one thing I would add is that one of the other reasons why we wanted to do it is because of how Burt started and his home-built community, a very grassroots-based community. We also thought that doing a Kickstarter campaign would be a good companion to the traditions of Burt.
Is Burt ever not designing an aircraft? Or is that just sort of, you know, kind of a, you know, a popular
myth? He tried to retire. Yeah. He did try to retire, but he got up to Coeur d'Alene and he and his wife, Tanya, bought a house overlooking Lake Coeur d'Alene. And they were taking pictures of the sunset and admiring they have this tremendous view out across the lake. And they were watching these boats, you know, kind of like little tiny specks out there making waves across the lake. And Bert, they started thinking, well, it'd be fun to have a little boat out there. But Bert, being Bert, started thinking, well, you know, you can only explore this lake if you have a boat. How about if you have a boat that could hop from this lake to another lake? And the issue with Coeur d'Alene, or Lake Coeur d'Alene, is that it's a fairly big lake and they get some fairly big waves there. Hmm. Which makes it very difficult for seaplanes to land and take off when you get any kind of surf at all or any kind of waves. So he started thinking, well, how can I overcome this? And he developed this idea of having skis that would actually come down and kind of be a damper on the waves and allow you to ride above that, essentially. And so he went out and tested that with a little built a thing out in front of it. I don't know how familiar you are with Burt's design technique, but he always did what he called a land shark, and basically put a model of the part of the plane, or sometimes a whole plane, on the front of a pickup truck and ran it up and down the runway, right, and figured out the aerodynamics of it that way. It's kind of a homemade wind tunnel, essentially. But he did the same thing with these skis and figured out how to get that to work. And then he realized that, well, if you've got these skis that allow you to land in almost any kind of waves, you could fly pretty much anywhere. You don't have to just hop to the next lake. You could land on snow, you could land in the ocean, you could land on grass or even rocky slopes, you can land anywhere. And so he started thinking about what that meant and what else would he have to do to make a plane that would allow him to escape from, you know, he'd lived at airports all his life, basically, or all his adult life, and he was sick and tired of airports. And so he started thinking, well, what can I, I've got a plane that doesn't need an airport to land in, what else do I need to do to make that a reality? And so this plane that he's got is basically a plane that he thinks he's going to be able to go around the world without ever seeing an airport.
Oh, does he actually have an around the world flight in his future?
What he's calling it is a Walter Mitty plan. And what that amounts to is that he's planning to get in the plane. His wife, Tanya, is about to get her pilot's license. She's getting a seaplane license first. And they're going to take a Walter Mitty flight around the world. He thinks it'll take him about 9 months, flying from good air to good air. So he'll never actually have to fly through or land in a turbulent atmosphere. And he'll determine his locations by where the good air is going to be. You know, there are apps that you can get on your iPad now that tell you where good weather is going to be pretty accurately. You know, you can go all up and down the elevations and figure that out. And he's got this plan now that he thinks he's going to be able to basically go all the way around the world without ever hitting bad weather.
Sandy, explain, or Scott, how is this different from a more of a conventional seaplane?
Well, there are a couple key things. One is that it uses these skis that allow it to land on ocean waves or wherever you want.
So there's skis, not really floats?
He has floats, but the skis come down from the floats, and they're retractable. And they've got little wheels on them, so you can land on if you want to land on a runway, you can. But they will allow whoever's flying the plane to land in such a way that, you know, if you've got 3 foot, 4 foot swells, you've got enough cushion there that you can still put the plane down and then just basically surf down to the beach and go on the beach and go from there. So that's a big, big difference. There isn't any plane out there that can do that now. There was a plane, according to Bert, called the Sea Dart, I believe, in the 50s that had skis like this, but that's no longer around. So that's one big difference. It's got a 44-foot wingspan, so it's not actually even going to be classified as a normal plane. It's going to be classified as a powered glider. And so he'll be able to kind of sloop basically out of the kind of certification issues that he's run up against. And it's got, you know, a few other features that are pretty unique to this plane. He's expecting at least a 2,400-mile range on it. So he thinks that it's possible, for instance, to fly from California to Hawaii with this plane.
Is it a two-seat plane?
It's a two-seat plane with one main engine, and it'll have two electronic motors as well. He's calling them docking motors that'll allow him to back up or go forward while he's in the water. But they'll also provide a kind of escape hatch. If, for instance, he loses the main engine during takeoff, he'll be able to utilize these electric motors to come back around and then land against the wind if he has any issues. You know, that's one big problem that a lot of seaplanes have, particularly where he is, where there are a lot of trees around all the lakes. You know, if you lose your motor on takeoff, you're in deep doo-doo.
Yeah.
It sounds like with the skis going to Hawaii, if you run out of fuel along the way, like the guy in the Cirrus, you don't have to pop the chute. So another added benefit.
Well, he thinks he can do it all in daylight.
I see. Rob, what do you think about this?
I think anything Bert Rutan designs is magical.
Yes.
I really do. I mean, the guy is so far ahead of the curve, and he has been since the first time, I think the first airplane, I can't remember the first airplane I saw of his, but it was a long time ago. But he manages to stay ahead of everybody. And I just think that is absolutely astounding. So I'm really impressed, and I can't wait to see this thing go. Actually, I think he just wants the two-seaters so he could spend more time with his wife. And she always knows where he is.
Yeah. And Bert is he's no kid anymore. You know, it's impressive that he continues to make designs that are as interesting as this. Sandy, how did you guys come to meet Bert originally?
Well, we met Bert originally in 2004 when Discovery Channel came to us and asked us to produce, direct, and write the Black Sky Race for Space and Black Sky winning the XPRIZE, which was a Discovery Channel 3-hour special that followed the design and build and test flight of Spaceship One. But for me personally, I became aware of BERT in my childhood because I was raised, my father was a pilot, and I grew up, in private aviation. And so my dad would, every once in a while, we would see a Rutan plane and he'd always point them out to me. But Scott and my relationship with BERT started in 2004. And we've been filming up in Mojave ever since. We followed the Spaceship One program. Once that was completed and the XPRIZE flights were completed, we continued to film with the start of Spaceship Two and Virgin Galactic. We made a show for National Geographic about the Virgin Galactic space line. And then we really started to follow BERT in 2011 for this project when we filmed his retirement from Scaled. And we've been traveling up to Coeur d'Alene since, I guess our first trip up there was in 2012, 2013. Hmm. So it's been a long and developing relationship.
So I suspect that he doesn't see you guys as the pesky film crew that are annoying what he's trying to do.
Well, it depends on it depends on the day.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay.
but you get used to that as a film crew because it's pretty common for your subjects to sometimes get tired of you being around. But no, it's an enjoyable process. Scott spent a little bit more time up there with BERT than I have because Scott's a cinematographer and shoots most of our films that we make. But I think he enjoys, he's excited that the story's being told. And I think that he enjoys telling the story and interacting, but sometimes it's also tough to have a camera on you all the time.
No, I would imagine.
It's a lot easier to have us around when everything's going swimmingly. If there's something going awry, BERT gets a little testy about, he doesn't like to be wrong, that's for sure.
No, that's understandable. How about on the other side? Does he ever ham it up for the camera?
I think he's a lot of fun. He loves to tell jokes. He loves to pull pranks. He's a very funny guy. So he's certainly, as Tanya says, Bert's an extrovert. He loves interacting with people.
But I also think...
Go ahead.
No, but I was going to say, I also think that BERT has a long tradition of being of showmanship. And if you look back at the RAF years and his kit planes and his getting the message out, salesmanship, and some of the old films of that time... I mean, I think it's a large part of some of his success is that he could really get up and hold the attention of large crowds. And he would put every Saturday during the RAF years, he would be there for people to fly in and ask him questions. And he was there to help people. So his being in front of people and a showman and selling and just wanting to convey his ideas and get people excited about what he's doing. And he, in turn, being excited about people building his planes and flying his planes is just a part of what has made him who he is and what's given him the success he's had, I think.
Yeah, I think that a lot of sort of entrepreneurial visionaries, let's say, have those kinds of qualities. You almost need to have that. Maybe he's kind of a Steve Jobs of the aviation industry in a sense.
We would certainly agree with that.
And there's a certain parallel too to his story to the, working in kit planes and home built planes in the 70s was the same sort of culture that Steve Jobs and Steve Wozniak were in the Silicon Valley at the same time. There are a lot of Heathkit computers that people were making from parts. And in fact, the Apple was the first real computer that didn't you didn't have to put together yourself, that you could use in your living room. So,
right.
I mean, that was the same era that BERT was really starting. So they have a lot of similarities, a lot of parallels between the two of them.
So what is the plan for the film, for releasing it? What schedule are you anticipating?
Well, we're really looking at an end of the year release, beginning of 2016. There's still a lot going on with Skigal, and the design and build of Skigal is a really compelling present day story that'll run through the entire length of the film. So we're going to follow that and follow the unveil and follow BERT and Tanya as they launch onto their trip. And simultaneously, you know, we're also going back and interviewing and doing a historical look at his career as well. So it'll take us until the end of the year to really have those two different pieces pulled together.
So, Scott and Sandy, this brings me back to my original question. So you guys launched the Kickstarter project back in February of this year, correct?
March, actually.
Okay, and close enough. I'm assuming you started on the project before then, which means that it's more or less been a year of your life that you've been working on this from start to finish, correct?
Really, more than a year.
Right. Okay, so you're this just reinforcing my point. My point is, through Kickstarter, you raised $106,000. There are two of you. That means that it's more or less 50 grand a year. You take out taxes, so you're at about 30 grand a year. How the heck do you guys make money? Because that's just the starting part. So you guys are making, what, 18 cents an hour for doing this? I don't understand the economics of it.
The backers have given us from the Kickstarter campaign is really to get us rolling and keep us up with BERT right now in terms of the Skigal. We don't expect that to be able to make the whole film with that. Up until this point, we've been financing it ourselves. But at the same time, we're preparing now to go out to raise the rest of the funds that we need to complete the film and to get it released. So it's an ongoing process. We thought in a certain way that our goal, one of the things in terms of putting a project like this together is that you have to show people a little bit about what you're actually going to do with the footage and the material and how you're going to tell the story and present it. So part of what we're doing now is creating that element that we can show to foundations and investors and gather the rest of the funding we need. But, you know, we think that there's so much interest in BERT's life and what he's managed to achieve. And I think his story is so compelling in so many different ways and is really inspiring for the generations to come, that I'm fully confident that we'll have a lot of people who really feel like we do and want to and feel that it's important that his story get out. So we're confident that all of that's going to fall in place
I absolutely agree with you, and that's one of the reasons why I wanted to have you on the show, was the promotion of this and telling BERT's story. I think it's such a compelling story, and he's such a unique, special individual. So I'm so looking forward to watching this.
Well, are you guys going to be up at AirVenture this year?
Absolutely. It's going to be a big event for us. We're looking forward to it. We're going to be following BERT. You know, it's also a great event because isn't it the 40th anniversary of the Varieties?
That's the one I couldn't think of before. That's the first airplane I saw of his that I remember.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Thank you.
Were you there then?
I don't know. I was there, but I remember it. Anyway, you were saying about AirVenture.
Yeah, we'll definitely be at AirVenture following BERT and following what's happening with the Varieties. And, we'll be present. So we're really looking forward to it. We're actually traveling up to EAA next week as well. So EAA has been so helpful in this project. And really was enormously helpful to our Kickstarter campaign. And, you know, they're been engaged in Bert's career for its entire breadth of his career. So they have a lot of archival footage that's going to be great for the project. And it's just so we'll be there.
Scott, can you tell our listeners where they can go online to learn more about this film and perhaps also the other things that you're doing?
Well, you can, of course, go to antennafilms.com, which is our website. And to see the Kickstarter campaign, you could just Google looking up, way up, the Bert Rutan story, and that would show up. The Kickstarter campaign page would show up. And we've built another page, and we're in the process of fulfilling a new website for the film itself that's going to be created, where right now we have a little PayPal button there if people are interested in donating, but we're going to basically create a little more variety and filling out a whole page. Then that will be at lookingupwayup.com. And so that's kind of going to be our hub for the rest of the life of the film and into its future distribution as well.
I've only participated in Kickstarter funds while they were being funded, not after. Since you guys have reached your goal, what's the goal or incentive for people to continue to, I'm assuming they can still give you money through that project, but what's the incentive for someone to continue to contribute?
Of course, it's the ability to back the project, first off, but the rewards that we're offering are going to be identical. They're going to be the same rewards that we are offering during the Kickstarter campaign itself. We'll eventually have a page that makes that a little easier to negotiate on the lookingupwayup.com site. Right now, if people are interested in donating or participating in the film, they can choose a reward from the Kickstarter campaign site itself and then donate on our webpage and just tell us which one it is that you want. And we're honoring those requests as well. So, and very pleased to do so, honestly.
Oh, that's a great idea. That's fantastic. Great. Yeah.
Can I ask a quick question?
The other thing I just wanted to mention, too, is there's also a Facebook page for the film, which is also Looking Up, Way Up, the Bert Rutan story, where we post updates and, you know, there are links to other articles and current things that are in the press about Bert. And we're also posting updates and little film clips on that as well. So that's also another source for people to engage with the project.
Outstanding. Rob, you're going to say something?
Sure. I was going to say, can you tell us why you called your company Antenna Films?
We have a little saying, there's a definition of antenna, which is an organ for feeling, sight, and taste, which often comes in pairs.
Aha, uh-huh. Which is how you come up with the ideas for your stories.
That's right. We hope so, anyway.
The plot thickens even more.
No. So which of you came up with that idea?
Sandy came up with a name a while
ago. Yeah, I came up with the name a while ago, and it's just sort of ended up sticking. So it's also interesting for our industry because there's multiple definitions of antenna, some that are more typical for our industry, and then some of the definitions that just have to do with nature. So we've continued to think it was a good name for our company.
Very good. Very clever. All right. Well, we want to thank you, Scott B. and Sandy Guthrie, for spending some time talking to our listeners about this film. I think a lot of folks are going to want to follow along. And as I said, we'll have links to all those sites that they mentioned in the show notes at airplanegeeks.com. Be sure to check those out. The subject matter is just so fascinating. I mean, anytime you're talking about Bert Rutan or people like him, it just is, it's sort of a magnet for people who have an interest in that topic. And the fact that you're documenting this, I think, is going to make for a really interesting film. So wish you all the best of luck with that.
Thanks so
much, and thanks for having us.
And let me reiterate, too, that don't just come to we don't want you just to come to donate. We're really trying to build community and give people an opportunity to follow along with it as well. So it's not just looking for your cash. We're really looking to get everyone involved as much as we can to tell his story.
All right, very good.
Now, I think the only other thing I'd like to just say is regarding the Kickstarter campaign. I think it was so rewarding for us to see the amount of community that came to the campaign, and that there were people from all over the world that saw our Kickstarter, that supported the Kickstarter, and who are actively following. So, again, just to kind of piggyback off of what Scott was saying, we really hope that people keep coming on board and following what's happening.
Yeah, I think that's an interesting point because a certain number of Kickstarter campaigns seem to be about developing a product, and people contribute because they're buying the product or they want to buy the product, which doesn't exist yet. And the association between the donor and the campaign owners it sort of ceases after the campaign finishes, pretty much, you know, until that product is either developed or, in many cases, you know, it is not.
Max, so, you're describing me.
So yeah, a lot of people.
No, that's why I asked.
Yeah. it's a good point because a lot of people consider Kickstarter to be just like Amazon.com. I'm ordering something, you know, I'm giving money and I'm going to get something in return, and they don't realize
we're being a venture capitalist.
Right. Mm-hmm. But so
well, and that's definitely a new tack. And it's an important and perhaps is going to be a huge way that this crowdfunding is going to be working. But one of our, as Sandy kind of mentioned, I just to expand on that, you know, we've got over 800, almost 900 people now who are what we regard as our founders. They're people who are really helping us to make this possible. And we're grateful for their support and their interest, and we'll be engaging with them all the way through to till the project is long gone. So it's something that we're really. It was kind of an astonishing thing because we didn't honestly. It wasn't something that we were expecting to gain from this either. We were just surprised by the kind of enthusiasm that we found.
So that's interesting. It wasn't anticipated because, yeah, where I was going with this is that this is how you differentiate, you know, what you're doing from what so many other people do, in that, you know, as you say, this is in part to build a community, but also a sustainable community. And I think that's really, really, you know, laudable. And you guys are to be commended for taking that approach. I guess if you had to pick a topic or a subject or a person, you know, to build that kind of community around, you know, you've made a great selection.
Yeah, this one's pretty cool. A fascinating guy.
Yeah. So.
Yep. What's fascinating too about having that community is, I think one thing that was unexpected for us as well is that it's the Kickstarter has become a kind of fluid process in terms of developing our storytelling about this film, because there's so many people that are interested in Bert that have built a plane or flown in a plane or have a friend that's got one of Bert's kit planes. And so there are a lot of stories that are coming to us, and we're meeting a lot of people that are incredibly passionate about him and about flying and about engineering and aeronautics. So it's been, I think, a really powerful dimension to help us as filmmakers and storytellers to really get our story and get the story right about Bert. Mm-hmm. So it's been much more rewarding than I expected it to be, and rewards that don't have just to do with the money that was donated, you know, but also what people are bringing to us in terms of story.
Sure.
Well, even as an example of that, one of the rewards we came up with for the Kickstarter campaign was to have people send us a picture of themselves in front of a Rutan design so that we could put it into the credit sequence. which we thought, oh, yeah, once we started thinking about that, we can build a really cool credit sequence with these photographs and of people. And, you know, so it's kind of forming our vision of what this all means too, or how to relate the sense of what Bert's impact is on the community at large. So it's been a kind of surprising and rewarding and a lot of work. That was the other thing that was surprising. We'd never done this before, and just realizing how much work it actually amounts to do.
Well, when you say you've never done this before, you've made a lot of films before.
But we've never done a Kickstarter campaign.
Ah, okay.
We've never done, that's what I mean. It's a lot harder to do that. It takes a lot more to put up a campaign than our hearts go out to anybody who does it and doesn't make their goal, because that you don't get anything then. And it's a lot of work.
Hey, Max, I think it's kind of like doing the podcast. This is a heck of a lot of work. People don't realize how hard it actually is.
But it is fun.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, absolutely.
We feel for you.
Hey, Scott, I have one last question for you. Only because Bert doesn't return my emails. Since you're going to see him, if you thought this was a pleasant experience and you think he would be a guest on the show, I would love to have him on the show. Just asking him would be uh-huh. really helpful.
Yeah. Well, I know that he is reticent to do anything. We haven't asked him to do anything, or we did ask him and he said, no, you got to realize he's working, like 14 hours a day right now, 15, you know, he wakes up in the morning, he thinks about the plane, builds on the plane. That's all he's doing. So anything that encroaches on that time right now is just kind of, unless it's really easy or something that, you know, has an impact really on his legacy. He's very jealous of his time. But after when he has the plane ready, I think that he's going to, want to do a lot of promotion of it and he'll want to reach out to the world. And I'm sure that he'd love to be on your show as well.
Yeah, it's probably a lot about timing too. So.
Yes, exactly.
All right. Well, we've got to go on with the rest of the show.
Well, thank you so much.
Great. Well, thank you so much.
The didgeridoo means it's time for the Australia News Desk. Here's two of the craziest guys we could find south of the equator. It's Steve Vischer and Grant McHaren from the Plain Crazy Down Under podcast.
Dateline, 18th of May, 2015.
Well, g'day, folks. Welcome to the Australia Desk for episode 350. Good Lord, another milestone, Grant. How are you, mate?
Oh, mate, unbelievable. 350 episodes. Woo, go, guys. I'm not too bad.
Yeah, that's excellent. Now, Grant, let's start off with the sad news first, Grant. You know, we were so triumphantly talking in the last segment we recorded, you know, about, I don't know, a month ago, whenever it was, that we were going off to do air show commentary at Wings over Illawarra. Well, we didn't quite end up doing that because it got rained out, unfortunately.
Yeah, that's the one, mate. Just under a month ago, we're all excited, ready to go to Wings over Illawarra. And a few of us are actually on the plane landing in Sydney when we found the news. They decided that with Sydney and the surrounding areas had had a couple of weeks of really heavy rainfall. The place was awash. It was mud everywhere. And they had to take the really sad but important decision to cancel it. They did that at 11 o'clock, and the plane that we were on was on the way to the runway at that point. So, yeah, unfortunately, due to the really bad conditions, the rain kept going during the weekend off and on. So I think the place is still drying out even now.
Yeah.
So unfortunately, they had to can it. So our work on DVD and airshow commentary was, maybe next year.
Joe, I really feel sorry for Mark and Kerry Bright and the team there up there at Wollongong. They've put in such a huge amount of work, and we really had high hopes for that airshow, you know, really getting off the ground, as it were, this year. So let's hope onwards and upwards for next year. And, maybe we need to pick a time of year when the weather's not so bad. I thought Sydney always said they had better weather than Melbourne, Grant, but I'm not so sure.
Well, I tell you, it's been raising a few eyebrows because it's been unseasonably wet, shall we say. I just remember the three Wings over Illawarra events beforehand all went off great.
Yeah, they certainly did. So let's hope for next year. And, well, I guess, Grant, well, we have picked up another couple more commentary gigs later in the year. So let's hope that they don't get rained out either. Or think people might start thinking we're a bad omen, Grant.
Yeah, well, hey, then we could get paid to avoid air shows. Ha, ha, ha.
Yes, well, I don't care. As long as we're getting paid, I'm happy. Consequentious, monsequentious, Grant, as Daffy Duck once said, as long as I'm rich. Anyway, Grant, speaking of things that cost a lot of money, let's talk all things defense. Let's talk about the KC-30A tankers. We finally got the boom system running well, sort of.
Well, they've done dry contacts between two KC-30As recently, and although they didn't pass gas, they at least managed to dry connect. I'm going to stop moving down there because passing gas was bad enough, but where you go from this one, whew, don't ask. But at least they've proven that they're able to connect, and I believe the next step is going to be happening pretty soon related to actually passing gas between the two KC-30s. And then beyond that, it's off to the wedge tail. And once that's done, onwards and upwards from there for the rest of the fleet.
Now, of course, the aircraft have been operating. In fact, they've actually been operating across over there in the Middle East. So they have been, working in combat, in a combat theater, I guess, with the probe and drogue system. But they've had all sorts of commissioning issues with that boom system on that aircraft. In fact, most famously, one of the test aircraft several years ago, the boom actually fell off in flight. I think that was over in Spain, wasn't it, Grant? So
that was correct, doing some tests with an F-16 and, oops.
Yeah, it's a big oops. So fantastic. It says here that their boom system is capable of offloading fuel at a rate of 4,500 litres per minute. So that's excellent. Can also refuel the Globemaster and the F-35 when they come and the P-8 when it comes. So this purchase of the KC-30A, even though it's taken a long time to get this boom system running, very, very wise and an excellent platform for many, many years to come, Grant.
Certainly is, mate. And it was proven, I believe it was last year, or very late 2013, when they used a KC-30 to refuel. They took off from Amberley, they went down to South Australia, they refueled a few Hornets that were doing test runs at the Woomera test range. Then they went up to Darwin and refueled a whole bunch of other Hornets that were in the middle of an exercise, and then they flew back to Amberley, all with one aircraft, all in one day, and that with a whole lot of people on board as well, and that just had people's eyes bugging out all around the place within defence. So it's really proven itself, and yeah, as soon as that boom is fully running, I think it's going to be an incredible multiplier for this Air Force.
Now, I'll tell you what, the old 707 tankers that they replaced, I don't think you would have quite got that sort of performance out of those old machines, I'm thinking.
Not quite, mate. This is a pretty big heavy. You'd be pretty hard pushed to get this out of some of the other tankers that are available. It is the bigger one, and I think the decision is paying off.
Now, a bit of F-35 news. I think, Grant, in the last report we recorded, we talked about Squadron Leader Andrew Jacko Jackson, one of the first two Australian pilots to fly the F-35, having, in fact, done so, about a month ago now. Well, another milestone he set here, Grant, according to this article here in australianaviation.com.au, Jacko's actually flown now the first Australian F-35. The last one he flew wasn't an Australian one, but that set records for flying an F-35 for an Australian, but now he's flown one of ours.
That's right, mate. He took A35-001, the first F-35 on the Australian Air Force register, took it out for a bit of a spin at Luke Air Force Base. And he's quoted here as saying, "Whilst I'm told that all the F-35s are the same, it is awesome to finally go flying in a jet that has Skippy painted on the side."
I tell you what, do you reckon if Matt Hall had stayed, in the Air Force, do you reckon he'd be flying F-35s now? I reckon he might be.
He's a wing commander. I don't know. I think he would be faced with the mahogany bomber in a staff job, unfortunately.
I don't think he would have been quite as happy doing that as he was, being a Red Bull Air Race pilot. So we should report on his success. Coming second in the latest Red Bull Air Race round just yesterday as we record this over there in Japan. So I tell you what, he's come second to Paul Bonhomme, which is actually exactly what happened in Abu Dhabi in the round before. So nothing like being consistent, I say.
That's the case, mate. And I think you had a few good words to say about it.
He certainly did.
Yeah, it was actually a pretty tough week because we didn't fly the plane for 3 months, and the plane is a lot different to what it was last year. So we only had one training flight, and I felt like a stolen plane. It didn't feel like my plane. So I'm really happy with how we've come onto it, and hopefully in the next race we'll be current and straight into it.
And that audio there, thanks to the Red Bull Air Race content pool. Yeah, fly it like you stole it, I guess. I wonder if he really regrets saying that. You can sort of watch him on the video saying, Yeah, maybe I shouldn't have said that. But anyway, second by only 0.382 of a second, Grant. And we watched that on the live stream, you and I. And, you know, it was a bit of a nail biter, actually. It was really quite close. But watching Paul Bonhomme, the British pilot, fly so smooth and such great use of energy the way he does it, it's really a joy to watch. It's just a pity that he's British and not Australian. We could have had two people on the podium then.
Well, you know, who rejected British colonies? I guess that's why we get on with the Yanks so well. But, you know, yeah, look, I got to say, I did post a tweet to Matt saying, you know, to Matt All Racing, saying, you know, congratulations, we're all breathing again down here. So slightly paraphrasing Apollo, but yeah, it was Kit and I were watching it at our place and going, come on, Matty, yeah. Yeah, it was good fun.
Yeah, it's fantastic. And just here in the Red Bull Air Race World Championship standings now after two rounds, it actually is Paul Bonhomme in the lead, Matt Hall second, and that makes sense since they've both come consecutively first and second in both rounds. So, yeah, that's good to see Matty at the top there. I tell you what, he's close. He's real close, and, you know, having those winglets on that that MXS of his now is really making a big difference, I think. So,
yeah.
Plus he's learning a lot, but I tell you what, Grant, an interesting article here. He may be struggling a little bit for sponsorship. So, you know, this article here in the Australian.com.au by our old friend Steve Creedy saying that Matt Hall is, you know, just on a bit of a shoestring budget because he's looking for a major sponsor. So maybe we need to get, you know, Rob Mark to sponsor him from Comavia or something.
Yeah, well, I mean, he's sponsoring the Airplane Geek, so he must be loaded. So, you know, come on, Rob, step up and join our mate Bus at Oz Runways. Oz Runways have got their logo on the big nose there of Matt's aircraft. So where would we put Comavia?
Well, I don't know. I'll have to think about that. Maybe we could take suggestions. Maybe people could ring into the feedback line and give us suggestions for where we could put Comavia on a race plane.
Hey, I got a few ideas.
Do you think it'd only take a minute to fly around the track?
Hey, there you go. Oh, hang on. No. Rob's aviation minute takes at least 3 or 4.
There we go.
Yeah, he'd be disqualified. Oh, no.
Let's not pick too much on Rob because, you know, he might actually be on this week and he might pick on us back and there's nothing we could do about it.
Hey, look, you know, Rob's just this guy, you know.
Oh, there you go. Well, that's everything we have for you on this week's Australia SG. It's nice to be back after 3 or 4 weeks. I think we should do another one next week, Grant. What do you think?
Well, it is the bits and pieces, so maybe we should come up with something special.
Oh, okay. Let's have another week off. Until we see you again, I'm Steve Fisher.
And I'm Grant McCarran. Where did I put that six-pack and beach chair?
Yes, must be there somewhere. Never too far away in your studio.
Yeah, well, and you wonder why there's no space in my studio.
You never know what you're going to get with the Australia desk, huh?
Ooh, those guys.
Rob, are you on mute?
I think his feelings were hurt and he's off crying somewhere.
I hope not. Rob, I hope you're just on mute. Maybe he took a bio break and yes, he didn't hear the Australia desk.
That would be terrible.
That would be terrible.
All that effort for naught.
Rob. Boy, you know, it's a real shame that the Wings Over at Illawarra show had to be canceled. You know, all that planning and, I mean, not just what the what Steve and Grant had planned for the show, but, you know, everybody else, the participants and everyone. It's a real shame when something like that happens, but the weather's the weather, I guess.
Yeah, I just wish we had some rain here in Southern California, but no weather talk.
No weather talk. Another, you know, they talked about a sponsorship, and this was here's an unintended segue or an unplanned segue. Let me say, we have a donate button now on airplanegeeks.com.
Yay!
Yeah, and if you take a look at the website over on the right-hand side, you don't have to scroll down very far. There's a little donate button. It's a PayPal donate button. So if you'd like to support us financially, $1, $5, $10, $20, whatever you think is appropriate.
$100, $1,000.
$1,000.
We're not bashful about taking your money. No, not at all.
Not at all. We have our annual trek to the Udvar-Hazy Center at the Smithsonian National Air and Space Museum in June. That costs us a lot of money to get down there for housing and so forth, hotels rather, when we're down there. So if you'd like to help get us down there and support us financially in that way, that'd be greatly appreciated. If it's not something that you are able to do, that's fine too. No hard feelings, really.
hosting services, recording equipment. There's
yes,
there really is a lot that goes into producing these shows. And I really think, like Max said, if you can't afford it or saving money for flying lessons or whatever, please use that money towards that. Don't give it to us. But if you do have some extra pennies, we're quite happy to take them.
Always priorities. Also, the guys mentioned on the Australia Desk bits and pieces next week. So there are just a few days left between now and then. If you want to submit a recording, please do that pretty quickly and get that into us. Send it to the geeks at airplanegeeks.com, an MP3 file or whatever your recorder records. We can handle most formats. But something... 3 or 5 or 7 minutes long, let's say. You can talk about your interest in aviation, something interesting that occurred to you, someone who influenced you when it comes to aviation, got you started. Any kind of a story related to aviation, we'd love to hear from you.
Rob, and I talked with a guest for the week after as well, and this is going to be a good one. We're getting back to women in aviation.
Oh, so, good. It's about time.
Yeah,
Brian.
A little teaser for that. Yeah, I know.
Okay. I'm gonna sneak in a look and see who's coming because you've piqued my interest. Did Rob ever come back?
I was going to say, is Rob back yet? Rob, you there?
No, Rob.
Rob? No, Rob.
Let's move on to a little bit of listener feedback. We got a voicemail on our listener line. This came from Samuel. He said he lives in Denver, Colorado. He would like to purchase the DVD of the movie we talked about, Above and Beyond. That was from episode 348, Flying Above and Beyond with Harold Livingston. And as our listener said, Samuel, he wants to buy a DVD of that if it's possible, and wants to know how he could do that. Well, we knew that the movie was available on demand. Didn't think that it was available on DVD, but we checked with the account executive for the publicity company that is handling that, and there are no DVD details right now, just available on video on demand. But Deirdre did tell us or give us a list of all those places, which some of them we knew about, some of them we didn't. So if you'd like to find that movie, Flying Above and Beyond, the one that we talked about with Harold Livingston in episode 348, that's available on iTunes, Amazon Instant Video, which we talked about. Also, Vudu, V-U-D-U. Do you know what Vudu is? I've never heard of that.
I have heard of it. I've never watched anything over it. I have an Apple TV, and I love it, and it's great. It works. So, yeah, I get all my content from that.
It's also on Google Play. The movie's on Xbox, Sony's PlayStation, MGO, DirecTV, Verizon, AT&T, Charter, and Suddenlink. And beginning on May 22nd, just a few days from now, it'll be available on demand on Comcast, Time Warner Cable, Cox, and Bright House. So if... wherever you live, some of those may not apply, but there should be some place where you can find the movie that you can watch on demand. We all watched the movie in preparation for the episode, and it really is a good production, interesting movie, really worthwhile. I certainly learned a lot about a period in history that I was sort of embarrassed to say I really knew very little about. So it's a good movie.
I think that held true for all of us except David.
Yeah, David, I'm sure. David. Oh, we should. Speaking of David Vanderhoof, our Airplane Geeks official historian, David is still recuperating. He's, as far as we can tell, he's taking the medications he's supposed to be taking. His wife, Shell, is taking good care of him. He's very tired. It's going to take some time for him to get his energy back. But we fully expect that to occur at sometime in the not too distant future. So, we all can't wait for David to come back.
And didn't he say that he was going to be at Dulles shoot, why can I never remember the name of the event at the Udvar-Hazy Air and Space Museum on the 20th of June?
Yes, well, it was Become a Pilot Day, but they've renamed it.
And that's why I can't remember.
And that's why we can't remember it. But yeah, he...
How about almost Father's Day in Washington?
Something like that. Yeah, something like that. Yeah, but
the innovations of flight. I don't know, someplace. Shoot, I have to look it up.
David's direct quote was, come hell or high water, he will be there for the event. So I don't doubt that.
Innovations in flight.
Innovations in flight. We'll have a link to that in the show notes as well. And since we're mentioning it, please consider if you're in the area, Washington, D.C. area, Northern Virginia, or it could be Saturday before Father's Day, which is June 20th, I believe.
Yes, June 20th.
Great event.
Between 10 and 3.
That's right. Great event. Plan to stay afterwards. You can join us for dinner Saturday evening at a local restaurant. Those are always great fun. We'll have a lot of fans and listeners and just some great conversations about the day and about flying and aviation in general. So really, really worthwhile.
And if you know anyone that wants to be a corporate sponsor, again, I'm quite happy to talk to them about taking their pennies too.
That's right. We can work with that. Returning to listener mail, we also heard from listener Moshe. He also commented on the interview with Harold Livingston. He thought it was fantastic. He also says, a few weeks ago, you mentioned in passing how neat it would be to see airliners flying in formation. He says, well, it just so happens that El Al put on such a show recently for Israeli Independence Day. They had one 747 and two 737s. They flew in an arrowhead formation at 1,000 feet down the Israeli coastline, past Tel Aviv and other coastal cities, and over Jerusalem. And then he sends us the video that's on YouTube that we'll put a link to that in the show notes for sure. Take a look at that. It's kind of interesting to see commercial airliners flying in formation, something you don't see very often.
And subtitles in Hebrew.
That's right. It's all in Hebrew. He says that the beginning part in Hebrew documents the pre-flight planning. All right, do that again. He says the beginning part in Hebrew documents the pre-flight planning and briefing, and starting from about minute 38, you see the formation flying in action. Very cool. So thanks, Moshe, for sending that in.
And watching jets fly in formation, you really don't need the subtitles to figure out what's happening.
Correct, correct. We also heard from our friend Krzysztof in Poland. He says, just wondering if you'd heard about the Flarus. This is a single-engine jet aircraft. It looks like an LSA kind of an aircraft. It's a lightweight composite. They plan for it to be sold at a price of approximately 1.5 million euros. They expect the maiden flight to take place sometime this year in 2015. They're taking some pre-orders. But it's a really interesting looking little jet. Krzysztof says he's also going to interview the Flarus team in hopes to get some interesting news from them. Krzysztof is editor-in-chief of this Polish site, Info Lotnicz. My Polish is really bad.
And if he does a recording in English, he should submit it.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. We'd love to support Krzysztof in that way. But we'll put a link in the show notes to the Flarus site, which is, well, actually it's flaris.pl, and also Krzysztof's site, infolotnicze.pl, Polish site.
Yeah, so yeah, one more reason for people to come to our website. And it also kind of looks like a design that maybe Bert Rutan would have done.
You know, it kind of does. We'll put a picture in the website of this little airplane. It's got sort of, what do you call that kind of a tail, Rob? Like that twin vertical stabilizer?
Are you talking about a V-tail, or do you mean something like a B-25?
Something like a B-25.
I don't know, just a dual vertical stabilizer, I guess. I don't know if it has another name, at least not one I know.
Okay. All right. Well, again, we'll put a photo of that in the show notes and a link to that website. So we want to thank you for listening to episode 350 of the Airplane Geeks podcast. You can find us at airplanegeeks.com. If you want to go straight to the show notes, that's airplanegeeks.com/350. Yeah, 350 guys. It sounds it's almost like a milestone kind of an episode. It's a round episode number.
Max, it's just amazing that you've been doing them for as long as you have. Rob's been on from what, episode 10 when he made his first appearance,
really,
or something
early
like
on.
That.
Yeah.
It's
I was a
really
very
amazing.
Young child at the time.
we were all quite a bit younger. Yeah, yeah. I figured maybe we'd get, you know, 5 or 10 episodes, and that would have been a good run. And here we are again. So we want to thank our guests, Scott B. and Sandy Guthrie. They're executive producers and co-creative directors at Antenna Films. We'll put a lot of links in the show notes, but you can find a website for the documentary Looking Up, Way Up, the Burt Rutan Story. That's at lookingwayup.com. You can find us on all the usual social media places, Twitter, just look for Airplane Geeks, also Facebook, Google+. Also, we're on Stitcher.com and TuneIn Radio. If you want to send us an email, that's thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com. And, of course, we have a listener line. Benet was here last week, Rob, to tell us that number. But as she's not this week, we have this instead.
Please. The Airplane Geeks want to hear from you at 361-GEEKS-01.
Rob, it's great to have you back after being traveling for a while. Did you get to fly any planes, or were you just looking at
them?
Oh,
no. Yeah. Oh, I mean, yes, I did, actually. When I was down at Gulfstream in Savannah last week, I got to fly a Gulfstream G550 and a G450 and these big, cool business jets, and we went way up high, 51,000 feet. I've never
really?
Been that high in my life.
Can you see the curvature of the Earth at that height?
It's just starting to become visible.
Wow.
Just starting to become.
And how do they compare to, I don't know, like a Falcon?
Well, I don't know. I like the Gulfstream a whole lot.
Yeah, yeah.
It was very nice. But I'll talk more about that another night.
Okay. All right.
An aviation minute, maybe?
Could be.
Oh. Nice.
Oh. Or maybe a bits and pieces segment next week?
You know, that's actually a good idea. I might just save it for that. Because we're not meeting next week, are we?
That's right. We're off. So, yeah, send us a little recording. Brian,
so should I not show up next week?
More unpaid vacation.
Yeah.
Oh, you so could, I just won't show up next week then?
Yeah, you can show up, but you'll be by yourself.
Okay.
Okay.
Yep.
So, Rob, tell folks where they can find more about you.
Oh, they'll
online.
Find us on Facebook under Jetwine or under my name or on jetwine.com or Jetwine on Twitter. And I don't know, all kinds of other places. The Aviation Minute up on iTunes and I don't know, just all kinds of great places.
Very good.
At AirVenture in the summer.
Yeah, yeah. All right, and Brian Coleman, how do folks reach you?
People could get a hold of me at brian@airplanegeeks.com, and if anyone's interested in the back catalog, send me an email. We'll work out the details on how to get it to you, and if anyone has any ideas for corporate sponsorships, again, get in contact with me. Would love to. Beg for the pennies.
Okay. All right. And I'm Max Flight. You can find me here. You can find me every week Friday morning at the UAVDigest.com. Also with Mary Kirby on her Runway Girl Network podcast. That's called the PaxX podcast. Listen to Mary and I talk about once a month with a notable expert in the passenger experience industry. So besides that, we want to thank you again for listening. We really appreciate it. Opening and closing music is by Brother Love. Find him at brotherloverocks.com. So join us again next week as we talk aviation on the Airplane Geeks podcast. Bye, everybody.
Fly safely.
But you told me not to be here next week.
Okay. Say goodbye,
man.
Rob.
Night, everybody.
Hi, Rob.
Is this Max?
Yes, it is. How are you?
Oh, I'm just peachy.
I've been on the road for 10 days, and I got back about 2 hours ago. Boy, and my body is dragging.
Up, oh, here's Brian. He had to reboot.
Is he there?
Brian? Brian, can you hear us?
No.
We can see you, but we can't hear you.
Brian, we can see you. We're back.
So's the buzz.
For many, many years to come, Grant. Now, speaking of F-35, sorry, Grant. Now, moving on, Grant, and speaking of F-35, did you want to make some comments? Sorry, mate.
I just can't get a word in edgeways. I mean, Philip!
No, go on. Go for it.